And now to the wok and stir fries. I am reminded of college days when my roommates and I would whip up stir fries together. I was go-to mise en place roomie, you know, cutting up all the ingredients we would toss together, getting our sauces ready to go in these little dishes. And some of our creations, they were wilty. Other stir fries tasted real pretty good. We weren't consistent, but hey, you know, that's okay. What is your favorite stir fry? What questions do you have about the oil for your wok or the technique in the toss? 800-642-1234. Jay Kenzie Lopez-Alt is a chef and a New York Times food columnist. New cookbook is out. It's called The Wok, Recipes and Techniques. Kenzie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, good morning. At over 600 pages, I wondered if there was that much to say about woks and stir fries. I mean, clearly there is. And what I love about your cookbook is that it is like cut to the chase advice on woks, on techniques, on, you know, even picking ginger and basil, all of it. So let's start with the wok. And my college wok is no longer with me. Yours is still kicking. So do some wok myth busting for us. What should we know about the vessel itself?
Well, it's pretty simple. You know, you don't need anything fancy. You don't need anything expensive. The best wok that you can use for home is a carbon steel 14-inch flat bottom wok. And that's what I typically recommend to anybody who has a, you know, a regular Western home burner. If you happen to have a wok burner at home, then I probably don't need to be giving you advice anyway. But, you know, if you do have a wok burner, then a round bottom wok is what you want. But, you know, carbon steel is the material of choice for me because it can withstand really fast temperature changes in a way that, say, nonstick or clad pan, you know, ones that have coatings, you know, or layers of stainless steel or aluminum, they can't withstand the rapid temperature changes that a wok's going to go through. And carbon steel, you know, it's lighter than cast iron. It's less brittle than cast iron. So it's a pan that's going to essentially last forever. You know, I've had my same wok for since
you
college.
You can say
so
it. Early 2000, yeah. Over 20 years.
yeah, the same one. And I, actually, just last week, one of the rivets in the handle started to loosen, and some liquid started to leak out when I was making some chicken stock. But
you're gonna fix it,
still
right?
Not bad for 20
it's
years.
Sentimental.
Yeah, a rivet, you can just hammer right back in. So, you know, the other thing about carbon steel is that it gets seasoned. You know, so it gets that sort of black layer of black oxide, the same way that a carbon steel pan does. Although the seasoning on a wok is a little different from what you would expect from a Western skillet, but that layer of black oxide that you get from heating it will also give some flavor to the food. And that's sort of part of that essential wok hay flavor that we talk about.
Yes, we're going to talk about that flavor. But I want to, it was so neat how you talked about rubbing oil into the wok and then pretending that you made a mistake and trying to wipe off as much oil as you can with a paper towel. How do you clean and maintain a wok?
Yeah, so cleaning it is very easy. You know, You can use soap in a wok in the same way that you can use soap in a cast iron pan. It's not really going to harm the seasoning. What you really don't want to do is leave it wet. So cleaning it, you know, I typically use a bamboo scrubber, which is really all you need. Although you can also use a sponge. A sponge works fine. So you clean it out in the sink, and then what you really want to do is make sure it doesn't stay wet. So what I do is every time I'm done cooking with it, I put it back on a burner. Yeah, I wipe out all the excess liquid and then I put it back on a burner and let it heat up so that any little tiny droplets of water are going to evaporate. And then after that, I take a little bit of oil, you know, just a half teaspoon or so, put it in the bottom of the wok and rub it all over with a paper towel. And you want to sort of rub it out as if you accidentally put the oil in it and you're trying to get it out of there. Because if you leave too much oil in there, especially if you don't cook with it every day, if you leave a layer of oil that's too thick on there, the oil will reduce and it'll turn a little bit sticky, which can impart, you know, an off flavor to your food and also make it a little bit more difficult to cook in the next time.
How difficult is it to cook and to stir fry with an electric burner if you don't have gas?
It's a little bit more difficult than a gas burner. You know, the main difference is that with a gas burner, some of the heat will rise up the sides of the wok more efficiently than it will from a electric cooktop or electric or, you know, a resistance coil or a induction cooktop. But it's perfectly possible to cook in an electric wok. You just have to let it preheat properly. The most difficulty you're going to find is with the initial seasoning of a wok. So if you buy a cast iron wok, it generally comes with a coating from the manufacturer that is, you know, that's their design. It's a very thick sort of oil that's designed to prevent rust during shipping and storage. So what the first time you get a wok, you really have to scrub it out really well, and then heat it on every surface. And that's the part that you're going to have the most difficulty with on a electric cooktop, because heating those curved surfaces is tough. So you can do that either by removing any non-heat proof parts and putting it into the oven to heat it. Or you can use a handheld torch, you know, either a kitchen torch or something that you buy at the home center.
Chef Kenji Lopez-Alt taking us on a journey with the wok, not afraid of dad joke wok puns, as in your dinners will be a walk in the park. What questions do you have about preparing your rice or choosing soy sauce, the staple seasoning of most East Asian countries, as Kenji points out? Do you cook on an electric cooktop or don't have a wok in your kitchen? What workarounds do you want to ask about? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Chef Kenji Lopez-Alt here on the Ideas Network. Chef Kenji Lopez-Alt says, as far as putting dinner on the table quickly and easily, nothing beats stir-frying in a wok. So what do you think? We're exploring all the techniques and uses for a wok on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. What vegetable combinations do you like in your stir fries? What about stir frying fish? What questions do you have about knives and prep work or the spices? Join in 800-642-1234. Chef and YouTube cooking channel star Kenji Lopez-Alt with us for the hour. Let's head to the pantry for a moment. And I know that you have some great suggestions for filling out a pantry, but I want to zoom in on soy sauce and what recommendations you have for the soy sauce we use in our stir frying.
Yeah, so soy sauce, you know, depending on the country, there are different types of soy sauce. And it is a little bit confusing because, so both in Japan and in China, they have what's called light soy sauce and dark soy sauce. And those things are not the same. And then there's also in the US, typically you'll find something called light soy sauce, LITE, which is also not the same as either of the other two light soy sauces. So it can get a little bit confusing. So in Chinese cuisine, light soy sauce is typically used for flavoring. So it tends to be a little bit saltier and a little bit richer in flavor. Whereas dark soy sauce is typically used more for the color. So it has a darker color. It's not as salty. It's not as flavorful, but it also has a little bit of a sweetness to it. So very often in stir fries, you'll see a combination of both Chinese light soy sauce and Chinese dark soy sauce. But if you're only going to get one soy sauce, I would recommend the Chinese light. Now with Japanese soy sauce, it's similar in that the light soy sauce is saltier and a little bit stronger in flavor. But Japanese light soy sauce tends to be even saltier than Chinese light soy sauce. Whereas Japanese dark soy sauce, which is called koikuchi, is more actually similar to Chinese light soy sauce. So on a spectrum, Chinese dark soy sauce is the darkest and sweetest. And then Chinese light soy sauce and Japanese dark soy sauce are pretty similar.
Okay.
And then finally Japanese light soy sauce. So I would if you're only going to get one, I would recommend either getting Japanese dark, which is your regular sort of shoyu, you know, like your kikkoman, your very run of the mill soy sauce, or a Chinese light soy sauce. I recommend Pearl River brand.
Okay.
And if you're going to get multiple soy sauces, then I would get a Chinese dark and a Chinese light. Now the American light soy sauce, LITE, that comes in a bottle with a green cap frequently. That is just low sodium soy sauce, which, you know, I would only recommend if you're on a low sodium diet, but it's different from the other types of soy sauces.
Kenji, if your bottle says naturally brewed soy sauce, what does that mean? And should we go for that?
So yes, you should go for that. If it says naturally brewed, I mean, very frequently you will find soy sauces that are naturally brewed that don't have that on the label. But what it usually really means is that it's made from wheat and soy, and that it's naturally fermented. There are some other soy sauces. In fact, there are some soy sauces that are not really made the traditional way at all, and that will be made with yeast extracts. So something like a sort of an inexpensive brand like La Choy, for example, is made with yeast extracts to flavor it. So it's a much sort of quicker process to make, and it also has a very different flavor. So generally, I would look at the label of the soy sauce, and you don't want to see yeast extract in there. You want to see wheat, soy, and salt. And then it'll sometimes list the bacterial cultures that are added to it.
Checking the labels for sure. You know, Kenji, I hung on your every word on ginger because it was so helpful on how to pick out ginger, how to cut it up, how to store it. Can you give us a little primer on ginger for our stir fries?
So often you won't have many choices, you know, depending on where you shop, you won't have many, many choices as to the quality of your ginger.
Right.
But ginger, you know, in my head, I tend to divide it into two categories. There's older ginger and younger ginger.
Mm-hmm.
And the young ginger, so if you take young ginger and you feel it, it'll feel kind of moist on the outside and you should be able to very easily kind of scratch the skin with your thumb. Whereas older ginger will be a little bit more leathery. And so with younger ginger, you can actually get away frequently without even peeling it when you're cooking with it. So the way I slice ginger or the way I mince ginger is I'll chop it into sort of coin-sized discs.
Mm-hmm.
And then I smack it really hard with the side of a knife. The same way that I would say crushed garlic.
Yes.
And that'll break it up into little bits. And then you can just give it a very rough chop and it'll be ready to cook with. And with older ginger, I would peel it before doing that. You can peel it either with a knife or a vegetable peeler, or you can just scrape off the skin with a spoon, I find actually is the easiest way to do it. The other thing is that some stir fry recipes will call for slivers of ginger or julienned ginger.
Yes.
That's ginger that you're going to be cutting lengthwise, you know, with the grain. So, when you have a recipe that calls for that, I really try hard to look for younger ginger because older ginger will be sort of tougher and more stringy.
Talking about how to use the wok with chef and author J. Kenzie Lopez-Ault. The book is called The Wok, Recipes and Techniques. Fielding your questions at 800-642-1234. Okay, oil. Here we go. What oils would you recommend for stir frying? Because there's a lot to work with out there.
Yeah. For stir frying, you want an oil that's going to be stable at a high temperature. So generally that means a refined oil. So you don't want anything like extra virgin olive oil or roasted sesame oil or anything like that. What I typically use is rice bran oil. That's what I use at home. But you can also use something like canola or peanut oil or vegetable oil. You know, anything that you would say sear a steak in is going to be okay for stir fry, something that's going to be stable at a higher temperature. Other than that, you know, the other oils you want to have in your sort of pantry are flavoring oils, things that'll go into marinades or sauces or to use to finish dishes. For that, the most essential one is roasted sesame oil, which you can find these days in most, you know, Western supermarkets. And if you are very lucky, you'll also be able to find something called kaiziyu, which is a Sichuan roasted rapeseed oil. So it's the same plant that canola oil comes from, but it's an unrefined oil and the plant is roasted first. So it has this kind of dark color. Some people describe it as a mustard oil flavor. To me, it tastes more sort of like roasted barley, if you're familiar with something like roasted barley tea.
Okay.
But it's sort of the essential oil of Sichuan. So if you're particularly into Sichuan cuisine and you want to capture that real, you know, the flavor of a Sichuan chili oil that you found difficult to capture at home, it's probably because you're missing that roasted rapeseed oil flavor. I'm lucky enough that I live near a very large Chinese supermarket that happens to carry it, but I've also lived in major cities such as San Francisco and New York where I couldn't find this particular oil. If you can't find it near you, you can order it online.
There is always the internet.
Yeah. I recommend malamarket.com. They have they have all of those Sichuan specialties.
Well, Kenji, let's take a call now. Dwayne is joining us from Weston. Hi, Dwayne. Go ahead.
Oh, good morning. So I like cooking all this kind of food, and I love making like a 5-spice pork. It's a bit of labor of love. You know, you're scrambling eggs and doing all the vegetables. And, you know, the 5-spice is really unique. And, you know, it's got fennel, clove, star, anise, white pepper. But what is a good way to what oils should you use to like hot wok the chicken or pork?
Mm-hmm.
And then another thing I make is, this is an amazing recipe. It's tangy Asian chicken thighs, and you use apricot preserves, and you up apricots and honey and ginger and soy and cayenne, and then you just simmer that, put it over. It's really good. What oil should you use? Sesame oil, like when you're hot walking the meat?
Yes, that's a great question, Dwayne. And Kenji, we're going to get close here to a news break, so let's start with the oil, and then we'll come back to Dwayne here. So go ahead.
Yeah. Again, when you're cooking anything over very high heat, you don't want to be using something like sesame oil. So you basically, the more flavor an oil has, the less you want to heat it, because that flavor comes from volatile compounds that are in the oil. And those things are going to dissipate as you start cooking. And so, you know, a general rule of cooking is if you can smell it in the air, that means it's leaving the food. Flavorful oils you want to generally finish with, so that most of the flavor stays in the food and doesn't hit your nose until you're starting to eat. But the other thing is that those flavor compounds are also going to break the oil down. So when you're searing the meat, you know, when you what you called hot walking the meat, you do want to use a neutral oil.
Let's pause right there. We'll pick this up on the meat after a news update on the Ideas Network. Chef J. Kenzie Lopez-Alt writes about how ever since woks were introduced to Western cooks, they've had a cozy but troubled relationship with vegetables and health-conscious cooking. So how do you stir-fry vegetables but bring in new flavors, complement your meats? We're talking about it on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Kenji's new cookbook is called The Wok. It goes deep, over 600 pages of tips, delicious recipes. We got this. Is your wok a go-to pan in your kitchen? Are you thinking about buying a new one? What issues have you come across with your stir fries? How is that steamed rice doing? 800-642-1234. Kenji Lopez-Alt with us for the hour. So we were talking there about meat, and how do you prevent meat from becoming hard and dry and stringy when you cook it in the wok?
Yeah. Well, you know, as with a lot of things, the most important step in preparing meat for the wok comes before you put it into the pan. So that's true. You know, that's true for vegetables or meat or virtually anything else you're going to be cooking. The prep is the really important part. So with meat, there's a couple things. First of all, you obviously want to slice it properly. You want to be, in most cases, there are some exceptions, which I go into in the book, but in most cases, you want to be slicing the meat against the grain. So, you know, if you have the muscle fibers running in a certain direction, you want to be cutting against in the opposite direction from those muscle fibers in order to shorten them. And that's going to make the meat more tender. But the real key to getting super tender meat is properly washing it and marinating it. So the washing step is something that might be unfamiliar to a lot of people, because especially with Western cuisine, you don't typically want, you know, no. There's this whole thing going around whether you should wash your chicken
turkey.
Or not.
No.
Yeah, exactly. And the general advice is you don't wash it because it doesn't really benefit the meat. And it can spread bacteria around your kitchen. With a lot of stir fries, you do actually want to wash your meat after you've sliced it into smaller pieces. And so what I do is I put it into a bowl with water, and you can try this side by side. It's very easy to see the difference, but you put it into a bowl with water and you really, really sort of roughly wring it with your hands the way you would say wash a stained piece of clothing. So you want to really be squeezing it and massaging it. And you would do this in your sink so that you're not splashing, you know, raw meat juices around your kitchen to make sure that you keep anything that you're going to be, not going to be cooking away from it. But you really squeeze it out, and then you change the water several times until it starts to run clear. And what this does is it, first of all, it loosens up the muscle fibers so that they are much more tender. It's like a night and day difference. If you've ever, you know, even at this sort of most inexpensive Chinese takeout place, if you've gotten, say, like the beef chow fun, the beef comes super tender.
Yes.
And the way they get that is largely through the washing process. And then the next important step is the marinating. So when you marinate meat, again, you want to be relatively rough with it. You really want to work the marinade in between the fibers. But the one key ingredient that I use in most of my marinades, not all of them, but most of them, is a little bit of baking powder. So the alkalinity in baking powder actually also tenderizes the meat. So you can use baking powder. If you don't want to use baking powder, you can also use egg whites. So a lot of recipes will call for egg whites. And the role of the egg whites there is to add alkalinity. And that's going to also make your meat very tender.
How long do you marinate, or how, you know, do you want to really soak that meat in there, and for how long?
Yeah, you can. So you can go up to overnight. You can also, you know, brine your meat the same way you would brine a chicken, you know, a chicken breast or a pork chop. You can brine your meat up to overnight in the fridge. At a very minimum, you know, I would say about 15 minutes is enough. And especially, you know, the thinner you slice it, the faster the marinade is going to work in there. But, you know, there's no disadvantage to marinating longer in this case. You know, with some sort of Western style recipes where you have a big piece of meat that you're marinating, you might run into the problem where it'll slightly cure or it'll get too salty if you let it sit in the marinade for too long. With most stir fries, the entire marinade and the meat are going to go into the final dish anyway, so you don't really run into that problem because the salt level is not going to change in the final dish. So yeah, you can marinate longer, and the longer you marinate, the better it's going to be. But at a minimum, I'd say 15 minutes at room temperature, but you can do up to overnight or even longer in the fridge.
You shared a couple recipes with us. One is the Springfield style cashew chicken dish, and I'm looking at it now. This is not the one I tried from the cookbook, but I'm wondering if you could kind of share how you found your favorite coating for the chicken, and the, you know, kind of a little bit of background on this particular cashew chicken dish.
Yeah. So Springfield style cashew chicken is what I consider sort of the first real Chinese American dish. You know, it comes from Springfield, Missouri, and it was based on a Chinese immigrant who was trying to make a dish that appealed to the local palate. And so what he did was he used sort of an American style fried chicken and served it with an oyster sauce based Chinese sauce. And that, you know, that's still very popular in Springfield. But it's sort of, if you're familiar with dishes, say like, you know, General Tso's chicken or crispy orange beef, or if you're in the West Coast, orange chicken, those are all dishes that start with a sort of breaded, battered fried chicken that you then toss with the sauce. And so, you know, the goal with those dishes for me is always to get a coating that's going to stay crispy even when you toss it with a sauce. And that's a relatively difficult thing to achieve. I got there through lots and lots of testing. So I tested, you know, everything from the type of flour you use, whether the ratio of cornstarch to flour, to the marinade, to the sort of thickening agent you're using to coat the meat, to get the flour to adhere. There's a bunch of sort of minor tricks that you use. And of course, the ratio of all those things is important. But the two key steps, the first one is to take a little bit of the marinade from the meat and drizzle it into the breading mixture. And I do this actually the same way, whether I'm making frying chicken that I'm going to be tossing in the wok, or whether I'm making, like a Southern style fried chicken. I take some of that marinade and drizzle it into the flour mixture and then kind of pinch it up with my fingers, just a very small amount of it. So a couple tablespoons into the whole bowl. I would pinch if I'm making an all butter pie crust. So I'm trying to get little clumps in there. And the idea is that you get these little clumps of flour that adhere to the surface of the chicken as you're breading it, and they give it more surface area. So more surface area makes more crunch. So that's the first step. And then the second step, if you want it to be really crispy and stay crispy, and this is something we do actually with the chicken at my former restaurant, is you double fry it. So you fry it once, you take it out, and then you can let it sit at room temperature until you're ready to serve it, or you can put it in your fridge overnight. Doesn't really matter. But right before you're about to go and toss it with the sauce, you fry it again. And what that does is it really dries out that exterior surface, so that there's, first of all, space for sauce to be absorbed, but it also prevents it from getting soggy once it absorbs that sauce.
Great tips as we explore the science and cooking of the wok and stir fries. We have the cookbook author, J. Kenji Lopez Alt. He's the author of the new cookbook, The Wok, taking your questions, 800-642-1234. Anne is with us in Wales. Anne, hi, what is your kitchen setup?
So I just have a flat pan. I love making stir fry, but I don't have a wok. So how horrible am I that I'm cooking it in a flat pan?
You're not horrible. I mean, you got to work with what you have. You know, you will, I think if you do happen to get to the point where you think that adding a wok to your kitchen is the right move, you probably will notice a few immediate differences. The first one is that a wok, you know, it's really conducive to tossing. That's really what the shape is best at. It allows you to toss the food in the air. And this is important for a couple reasons. The main one being it speeds up cooking through the process of evaporation. So the more you toss your food in the air, the more convection there is and the more moisture is going to evaporate out into your kitchen. So things are going to cook faster. They're going to cook hotter and it's going to prevent things from sort of stewing in their own juices. So that's really the advantage that a wok is going to give you in that department. It's also, you know, it's advantageous in other ways as well. I think it's the shape makes it better for, makes it more versatile. So you can do things like put a bamboo steamer or a stack of bamboo steamers on top if you want to make like a lot of dumplings or steam a lot of fish. It's really good for deep frying because those wide sides prevent oil from splattering out into your kitchen counter. You know, so a number of other sort of corollary things that come with that shape, but I think the main advantage you're going to find is in tossing. You know, that said, there are a lot of the dishes you can make in a regular, you know, Western skillet that are going to come out just fine. In fact, you know, most things are going to come out just fine. You might have to cook in slightly smaller batches because you don't want the sort of liquid coming out of the food to sort of sit there and stew. So that you that could to solve that, you just cook in smaller batches. The other thing you're going to miss is that you won't get the wok hei flavor, that kind of smoky flavor that we mentioned a little bit earlier in a Western style skillet, at least not as easily. And that's partly because of the shape of a wok allows you to toss your food over the back of it. And you know, especially if you're cooking over a gas burner, it allows that flame to actually hit the food and sort of ignite the oil and give you some of that flavor, which is really difficult to do with a Western skillet. But yeah, most dishes, you know, that said, most dishes that you're going to cook in a wok, and especially home style dishes, don't really get that flavor anyway and don't need that flavor. So you won't necessarily miss that in a Western skillet for most recipes.
And thanks for the question. Lynn now in Manitowoc. Hi, Lynn. Go ahead on your carbon steel pan, I understand.
Yes, I inherited a beautiful wok from my grandfather, but it has rusted over, and I want to know how to restore that for use.
Oh, so rust, you know, rust is really the only big enemy of carbon steel or cast iron. Depending on how bad the rust is, you know, there's one of two options. If the rust is so bad that the metal itself is actually sort of pitted and started losing its thickness, then you're kind of in trouble and there's not too much you can do about that. If it's just a real, if it's just a cosmetic thing, if it's just the surface, all you really got to do is scrub it out really well and then go through the seasoning process. So heat it up all over, rub oil into it. It might take a few repeated steps of seasoning in order to restore it and get it to the point where you can cook in it again. But it's really as simple as that. There's, you know, there's instructions you can find both in my book and also online for how to season carbon steel or cast iron. And that's really all you got to do.
Lynn, thanks for that question. Good luck with that seasoning. Chef Kenji Lopez-Alt giving us so much to think about with the wok. He's not afraid of dad joke wok puns, as in, are you nervous to rock out with your wok out? Not sure where to start. We've all been between a wok and a hard place. We'll be back. That's him, not me. We'll be back in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. It's The Wok, front and center on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The new cookbook is called The Wok. What else would it be, right? Chef Kenji Lopez-Alt giving us delicious recipes for The Wok, all the techniques, some chemistry in the mix. And Kenji's with us for about 9 more minutes. Let's move on to rice with Jim joining us from Cedarburg. Hi, Jim. Go ahead.
Morning. Thank you. Real pleasure to talk with you, Kenji. fried rice. Is this a regional kind of a dish? Is the rice fried literally? But before you do, could you tell us a little bit about yourself? I mean, you were in the business. We used to call it the School of Hard Knocks. Where did you get most of your education? And also, 600 pages. Did you know it was going to be this large of an endeavor?
Jim, thanks.
Okay, well, that was a multi-part question. my background, I started in the restaurant industry. So I started working in restaurants in college and then worked for a number of years after graduating. And then from there, for the last 15 years or so, I've been a recipe developer. So I started at writing and testing recipes at Cooks Illustrated magazine. And then from there, moved on to start the recipe section of the site SeriousEats.com. And now I work independently. So I freelance for the New York Times and I publish books and I have my YouTube channel, et cetera. As far as the length of the book, I did not imagine it being this long. In fact, it started out as a chapter in my first book, The Food Lab, the first book ended up also being too long. So we cut it for length and tried to stick mostly to the sort of American and American adjacent recipes. So the wok chapter got cut out of that. And then when I went back and started working on a sequel to that book, of which the wok chapter was only going to be a chapter again. As I was writing the wok chapter, I started getting further and further in it. I was 200 pages in, and by the time I was 200 pages in, I still hadn't finished writing about stir fries. And so that's when I called my editor and I told her, hey, why don't we just write an entire book on the wok? Because I got, I got 1,000 pages I can write about this, which I did. And then we cut it down again to 600 and whatever pages it ended up being. As far as fried rice goes, I'm not sure I fully understood the question, but I think the question is fried rice really fried, or is it really a traditional dish?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the answer to both of those questions is yes. Fried rice is actually fried. It's not deep fried, but it's stir fried. So it's fried in a bit of oil, a couple tablespoons of oil, in a very hot wok. And the real key to fried rice. So first of all, it's a great way to use up leftover rice. So if you steam a lot of rice and you only use half of it at your meal, which I typically do, I tend to steam much more rice than I need because I want the leftover rice for a couple other purposes. Most often that's going to be fried rice. And so what you're really looking for is not necessarily day old rice, although that does work. The key thing is having dry rice. So day old rice that's been stored in the fridge overnight, that'll work well. If you really have a hankering for fried rice today and you don't want to wait for your rice to dry out overnight, you can actually cook fresh rice and then sort of spread it out on a tray right after cooking it and allow it to steam dry. And then it'll fry up just fine that way. The real difficult timing with rice is if you have cooked rice in a rice cooker or in your steamer or in a pan and you use part of it for a meal but you leave the rest of it in that pan or in the steamer without spreading it out, then it's going to be very difficult to fry until you've let it rest overnight and really lose its moisture. So if you want to use it fresh, you need to take it out, spread it out so that it dries in the air, and if you otherwise you just use day old rice.
You're a fan of the rice cooker as well, I understand.
I am. Well, these days I use a pressure cooker, a multi-cooker, something sure. like similar to an instant pot. But but yes, I grew up, as anybody in an Asian household does, I grew up with a rice cooker on the counter that got used virtually every day. Because of that, I ate rice almost every day growing up, but I never learned how to cook rice in a pot. And so that was sort of one of my last culinary, white whales was learning how to properly cook rice in a pot, which is ironic given how often I eat rice, but it's just, I used a rice cooker so often, it's like learning to drive manual if you've been driving automatic your whole life.
Jolene now in Chippewa Falls with a question. Hi, Jolene.
Hello. You were talking earlier about double frying chicken to make it crisper. And my question is, okay, the first time you fry it, do you fry it to doneness, complete, and then cool it? Or do you, par cook it. I don't know what you call it. And then leave it sit.
That's a very good question. So the answer to that is yes. The first time I fry it, I cook it to doneness. So depending on the size of the chicken pieces, that's going to change the oil temperature. So for something that I'm cooking in the wok that are cut into small pieces that I'm going to be then tossing later on with sauce, I cook it at a normal frying temperature. So, you know, 300 to 350 degrees. I don't remember actually exactly what I said in the book, but the exact number is in there. 300 to 350 degrees or so. If I was cooking something like whole chicken pieces, I would start them at a lower temperature. So I would fry them at around, you know, 250, 275 so that they have a chance to cook all the way through. And then the second fry you do at the high temperature again, so 325 to 350. But yeah, that's a very good question. You definitely want to cook it through all the way the first time. And then the second time is really just to crisp up the exterior.
Fish can fall apart in the wok. Do you have any tips for stir frying fish, or in particular, you know, I really like the shrimp.
Yeah, well, shrimp and fish are quite different. So, you know, shrimp, I don't think you're going to have that issue of them falling apart.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, one thing that I do with shrimp that I similar to what I do with meat is I marinate it with baking powder. With the case of shrimp, the baking powder actually causes the shrimp to get a sort of crisper, crunchy texture. So if you've ever been to a dim sum place that has those crystal skin dumplings,
mm-hmm.
The starch skin dumplings with the shrimp inside, and you've noticed that the shrimp inside have this very sort of almost crunchy, snappy texture to them, that comes from marinating with baking powder. For the case of fish, there's a couple things you can do. So the first thing that you should do is start off by picking the right kind of fish. So you definitely don't want to use anything that's going to be super flaky. So avoid things like, you want to avoid things like cod or, mm-hmm. Or haddock or things, you know, things that you would, that would become very flaky. You want a really firm fish. So I typically recommend things like sea bass, striped mm-hmm. bass, mahi-mahi, which you can find generally frozen, or halibut. And then you want to marinate it. And then usually what I do with fish is I will do what's called velveting. And this is something you can do with meat as well. But what you do is you marinate it in a marinade that includes egg whites and cornstarch. And then before you stir fry it, you bring a wok full or a pot full of water to a simmer. And then you add the fish into it a piece at a time and just let it simmer just for a few moments and then fish it out with a fine mesh strainer or a spatula. And what that does is it firms up the fish. It gives it a sort of slick coating that's going to help it stir fry better without falling apart and also sauce to adhere better. But that's the real key for me for getting fish that has a really nice, moist, tender texture that doesn't fall apart as you're stir frying it.
Oh my goodness. This just makes me want to leave right now and start working in the kitchen with stir frying. this has been really a lot of fun. Kenji, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
J. Kenji Lopez-Alt, chef, New York Times food columnist, author of the new cookbook, The Wok, Recipes and Techniques. You can find the two recipes on our site, Springfield Style Cashew Chicken and Pepperoni XO Sauce, which we didn't talk about. You can find those two recipes there at WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.